A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's prompt this week wades into one of the most legally contested patches of ground on Earth. He wants us to look at the history of Israel's settlement program in the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, depending on your framing, and walk through why most of the world calls these settlements illegal. That includes the ring neighborhoods around Jerusalem and the Old City itself. Israel advances a minority position that the world is basically wrong, and Daniel's question is whether Israel would even acknowledge there's an occupation at all. He sees a military occupation by any normal definition, and he wants us to lay out both sides. So he pulled the ICJ's July 2024 advisory opinion, the Israeli government's own legal defense from their official portal, and Amnesty's occupation report to see where the law actually lands.
The ICJ opinion is the right place to anchor this because it's the most comprehensive international legal statement on the question to date. 12-3 vote found Israel's continued presence in the occupied Palestinian territory unlawful. But before we get to the court, we need the geography, because the law turns on a line drawn in 1949.
The Green Line.
The 1949 Armistice Line. The West Bank is about 2,800 square miles, roughly the size of Delaware, captured by Israel from Jordan in the 1967 Six-Day War. The Green Line was never a border. It was where the fighting stopped, but it became the de facto boundary between Israel proper and the territory it captured. And here's where the legal tension starts. The UN Charter, Article 2, Paragraph 4, prohibits the acquisition of territory by force. The Fourth Geneva Convention, Article 49, says an occupying power shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies. Those are the two pillars of the international illegality claim.
So the argument is straightforward. You can't take land in a war, and you can't move your own people onto land you're occupying. Israel moved roughly 700,000 of its citizens onto land captured in 1967. Ergo, illegal.
That's the international consensus. The ICJ, the UN Security Council, Resolution 2334 in 2016, passed 14-0 with the US abstaining, and about 164 states say the settlements violate these treaties. Israel says the West Bank is disputed territory, not occupied territory, because no recognized sovereign held it before 1967. Jordan's annexation was only recognized by three countries, the UK, Pakistan, and, I think, Iraq, maybe. The point is, the occupation framework in international law was designed for territory taken from a recognized state. Israel's argument is that there's no prior legitimate sovereign to return it to, so the Geneva Convention doesn't apply de jure.
That's the core of the minority position. And it's not a fringe view in Israel. It's been the official government line through multiple administrations. Walk me through what actually happened in 1948.
After the 1948 war, Jordan occupied the West Bank and formally annexed it in 1950. But the international community almost universally rejected that annexation. The Arab League threatened to expel Jordan over it. The United States, the Soviet Union, the entire UN, nobody accepted it except those three countries I mentioned. So when Israel captures the territory in 67, the argument goes, Jordan wasn't the legitimate sovereign, so who exactly was Israel occupying territory from? The occupation law framework assumes you're holding the territory of another state pending a peace treaty. If there's no other state, the framework doesn't neatly fit.
So it's not just a semantic dodge, it's a genuine legal puzzle. If I take your car, that's theft. If I take a car that was abandoned and nobody has clear title to, it's something else. The law doesn't have an obvious category for it.
That's the analogy Israel's defenders reach for. It's not perfect. The car wasn't empty. There were people living in it. But it captures the legal ambiguity they're exploiting. And this is where the history matters for understanding why the settlement program evolved the way it did. Let's trace how we got from 1967 to 500,000 settlers, because the phases tell the story. The settlement program has distinct phases. Phase 1, 1967 to 1977, labor governments. They built a few dozen settlements along the Jordan Valley and the Golan Heights, explicitly for security. They wanted a buffer against a potential Eastern Front. They deliberately avoided heavily populated Palestinian areas. The Allen Plan was the framework. Settlements as strategic depth, not ideological claims.
And the Allen Plan is worth a moment because it shows how different the early logic was. Yigal Allon, the labor minister, drew a line down the Jordan Valley and said, "We keep this strip for security, but we don't go into the Palestinian population centers." It was a military logic. Settlements were basically forward bases. Nobody was talking about biblical birthrights.
Right. The early settlements looked like kibbutzim, agricultural, small, defensible. The government didn't encourage mass civilian movement. They were selective about who could go and where. And then Begin wins in 77 and everything changes. Phase 2, 1977 to 1992. Likud under Begin and Shamir. This is when settlements push into the heart of the West Bank, driven by religious nationalist ideology. Gush Emunim, the Bloc of the Faithful, saw settling the biblical heartland as a religious imperative. The government backed them. The number of settlements jumps from a few dozen to over 100. Phase 3, 1993 to 2000, the Oslo years. The accords froze some construction, but the settler population doubled anyway. Natural growth, they called it. Phase 4, 2000 to the present, steady expansion under every government, left and right. As of 2024, you're looking at roughly 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank, plus another 230,000 in East Jerusalem.
When a settlement's population doubles during a supposed freeze, that's not just babies being born. That's new housing units, new infrastructure, new roads. It's expansion by another name.
And the roads are key. Every new settlement requires access roads, security perimeters, utility corridors. The physical footprint expands even when the number of housing units technically doesn't. You can double the population density of an existing settlement without formally establishing a new one, and the government can point to the map and say no new settlements. But the land under administration has grown.
And that East Jerusalem number is where the ring neighborhoods come in. Daniel specifically mentioned them.
Right. East Jerusalem was annexed by Israel in 1980 via the Basic Law on Jerusalem, which declared the United City the capital of Israel. The UN Security Council, Resolution 478, declared that annexation null and void. But Israel treats East Jerusalem as sovereign territory. Residents of neighborhoods like Gilo, Ramat Shlomo, Har Homa, they get Israeli ID cards, they vote in Knesset elections. Palestinians in East Jerusalem get permanent residency status. It can be revoked.
That's the distinction that trips people up. Gilo looks like a suburb. It's a suburb. 40,000 people, built in 1973 on land expropriated from five Palestinian villages. You can take a bus there from downtown Jerusalem in 20 minutes. Under Israeli law, it's Jerusalem. Under international law, it's a settlement. And the thing is, most Israelis don't think of Gilo as a settlement. They think of it as a neighborhood. If you ask someone in Tel Aviv where Gilo is, they'd say Jerusalem. The legal category and the lived category are completely disconnected.
And that disconnect is partly by design. The ring neighborhoods were built to create demographic contiguity between West Jerusalem and the expanded municipal boundaries. The goal was to make the annexation irreversible by putting enough Israeli citizens on the ground that no future government could conceivably divide the city. It's a strategy of facts on the ground, and it worked. No Israeli government in 30 years has seriously proposed relinquishing Gilo or Ramat Shlomo.
But how does that work legally from the Israeli side? If East Jerusalem is annexed and they say it's sovereign territory, what's the legal mechanism for expropriating land to build these neighborhoods?
The Land Acquisition Law of 1953, mostly. The state declares land needed for public purposes, compensates the owners, sometimes, and transfers title. But here's the catch. Much of the land in East Jerusalem wasn't formally registered under Israeli land law. The Ottoman and British systems were different. So the state could classify large tracts as unregistered or absentee property and take them without the legal hurdles that would apply to registered Israeli land.
So the same bureaucratic machinery Hilbert was going to describe, the maps, the classifications, That's the engine under the hood of the ring neighborhoods, too.
And the ICJ's 2024 advisory opinion was explicit on this point. The court found that Israel's annexation of East Jerusalem is unlawful, that the settlements there are settlements under the Fourth Geneva Convention, and that the systematic discrimination between Israeli settlers and Palestinians amounts to, and I'm quoting the finding here, apartheid under Article 3 of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination.
That word. Apartheid. The ICJ used it in a binding legal finding.
Advisory opinion. So not binding in the strict sense. But yes, they used it. 12 judges out of 15. The dissents came from Uganda's judge, who was appointed by Israel for this case, the American judge, and the Israeli ad hoc judge. The opinion also said all states have an obligation not to recognize the occupation as legal, and not to render aid or assistance in maintaining it.
And that's a big deal even if it's not technically binding, because it triggers obligations under other treaties. If the occupation is unlawful, then third states can't just shrug and say, not our problem. They have affirmative duties not to support it. That's going to ripple through trade agreements, arms sales, academic partnerships, all the places where states interact with the occupation without necessarily thinking about it.
The opinion is a roadmap for exactly those kinds of challenges. It's already being cited in domestic courts in Europe to block arms exports. The legal machinery is starting to turn.
So that's the international case. Settlements violate Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. The occupation itself, the continued presence in the territory, is unlawful. East Jerusalem is occupied territory, not sovereign Israel. And the legal regime that governs settlers and Palestinians differently meets the definition of apartheid under international law. That's what the world's highest court found.
Now let's walk through Israel's response, because it's not just, we disagree. It's a coherent, if minority, reading of the law. The Israeli government's official legal position, published on their portal, rests on several arguments. First, the disputed territory claim. The Fourth Geneva Convention applies to territory taken from a high contracting party, a recognized sovereign state. Jordan wasn't the recognized sovereign of the West Bank before 1967. It was an occupying power itself from 1948, so there's no prior legitimate sovereign to return the territory to. The legal framework of belligerent occupation was designed for a temporary situation where you're holding another state's territory pending a peace treaty. Here, there's no other state to return it to.
So the argument is, occupation law requires a previous owner, and there isn't one. Therefore, disputed, not occupied.
That's the first pillar. Second, Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention was drafted to prevent forced population transfers of the kind the Nazis carried out, deporting civilians into occupied Poland, for example. Israel argues it was never intended to prohibit voluntary movement of a state's own citizens into territory that isn't under anyone else's recognized sovereignty. The Israeli settlers aren't being transferred by the government in the way the drafters envisioned. They're moving voluntarily, often buying land.
That's a textual argument about the original intent of the convention. It's not nothing. The drafters were looking at Nazi deportations, and I think it's worth sitting with that for a second, because the historical context matters. The Geneva Conventions were written in 1949, 4 years after the Holocaust. The drafters had very specific horrors in mind. Article 49 was a direct response to the Nazi practice of forcibly moving populations around occupied Europe to change demographics. So when Israel says, that's not what we're doing, they're pointing to a real distinction. The question is whether the text covers more than just the specific evil it was written to prevent.
It's a real argument. Whether it persuades is another question. The ICRC's commentary on the convention explicitly rejects this narrow reading and says Article 49 applies to any transfer of population into occupied territory, voluntary or not. But Israel's position isn't invented from thin air. Third pillar, the Oslo Accords. The 1993 and 1995 agreements divided the West Bank into areas A, B, and C. Area A, Palestinian civil and security control. Area B, Palestinian civil control. Israeli security control. Area C, full Israeli control, and that's 60% of the West Bank. The accords explicitly left the status of settlements to final status negotiations. Israel argues this means the parties agreed, the settlements aren't per se illegal. Their fate is a matter for negotiation, not predetermined by international law.
Which brings us to Daniel's question about whether Israel denies there's an occupation at all.
This is where it gets nuanced. Israel's official position is that it exercises belligerent occupation in a technical sense over Area C, military administration, checkpoints, the whole apparatus. But it rejects the label occupier as implying wrongful possession. The government's legal briefs argue that Israel has no sovereign claim to the territory. They're not saying it's Israel, but also no obligation to withdraw unconditionally. Security control is presented as a temporary necessity until a negotiated settlement. This is distinct from denying the factual reality of military checkpoints, administrative detention, and land confiscation. They acknowledge the facts. They dispute the legal characterization.
So they don't deny soldiers at checkpoints. They deny that those soldiers constitute an unlawful occupation. It's almost a Schrodinger's occupation. It exists for the purposes of military administration, but doesn't exist for the purposes of international legal obligations.
And some voices in Israel go further. The Levy Report, a 2005 government commission, never adopted as official policy, but reflecting right-wing legal reasoning, concluded that Israel's presence in the West Bank doesn't constitute occupation under international law at all. Period. The report argued that the classical laws of occupation don't apply because the territory wasn't taken from a legitimate sovereign. That's the maximalist position.
And in 2022, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled in the Homesh Yeshiva case that settlers could return to an evacuated settlement in the northern West Bank, effectively reversing part of the 2005 disengagement from Gaza and four West Bank settlements. The court reasoned that the Oslo Accords didn't permanently bar Israeli presence in Area C.
That decision was a big deal because it chipped away at the legal barrier the disengagement had created. The court, Israel's highest, said, essentially, the Accords don't prohibit Israelis from being there. So the legal architecture is shifting even within Israel's own system.
Let's talk about what this actually looks like on the ground, because the legal theories produce a dual system that affects every aspect of daily life.
This is the part most coverage misses. In the West Bank, Israeli settlers are subject to Israeli civil law. Palestinians are subject to military law. Same territory, two populations, two completely different legal systems. If a settler commits a crime, they go to an Israeli civil court with all the protections that entails. If a Palestinian commits the same crime, they go to a military court under military orders that had been in place since 1967. Different rules of evidence, different detention procedures, different sentences.
Give me a concrete example of how that plays out. Same offense, two different outcomes.
Take stone throwing. If a settler throws stones at a Palestinian car, that's prosecuted under Israeli penal law. The maximum sentence is theoretically high, but in practice, sentences are often measured in months, sometimes suspended. If a Palestinian throws stones at a settler's car, that's prosecuted under Military Order 1651. The maximum sentence is 20 years. The conviction rate in military courts for Palestinians is over 99%. And the detention process is different. Palestinians can be held for extended periods without charge under administrative detention orders that are renewable indefinitely. Israeli citizens aren't subject to administrative detention under the same system.
So it's not just different courts. It's different laws, different procedures, different maximum sentences, different everything. Two people standing on the same patch of dirt are living in completely different legal universes.
The land regime. 70% of Area C is designated as state land or survey land under Israeli administration. Palestinians can almost never get building permits. Meanwhile, settlement construction continues. In 2025, new housing starts in the West Bank were up 35%.
35% in 1 year. That's not natural growth. That's a deliberate acceleration.
Then there's the settler violence. The UN's Humanitarian Office, OSHA, recorded over 1,200 settler attacks on Palestinians in 2023 alone. That's more than three a day. Amnesty International documented a pattern where Israeli security forces either stand aside or participate. And when investigations happen, the conviction rate is. The number that gets cited is around 90%, but that's the rate at which Israeli investigations clear the security forces themselves. The actual accountability rate is vanishingly small.
90% clearance rate for their own investigations. That's not a justice system. That's a self-audit.
It's a structural problem. The same military that's supposed to protect Palestinians from settler violence is also the authority that approves settlement expansion and administers the land regime. There's no separation.
Daniel's prompt asked us to present both sides. I think we've done that. The international position is clear and almost unanimous. The settlements are illegal, the occupation is unlawful, and the dual legal system constitutes apartheid under international law. Israel's position is that the territory is disputed, not occupied, that Geneva Convention Article 49 was never meant for this situation, and that the Oslo Accords punted the question to negotiations. Neither side is budging.
The ICJ opinion, while not binding, is now the most authoritative statement of international law on the question. It's going to shape state practice. We're already seeing it. Spain, Ireland, and Norway recognized Palestine after the opinion came down. The legal consensus is hardening.
But on the ground, settlement construction isn't slowing. The law and the facts are moving in opposite directions.
1994. I spent 6 months drawing the master plan for Ma'ale Adumim.
Wait.
Israeli Ministry of Housing. I was 24, needed the money, cartography mostly, roads, utility corridors, lot boundaries. The thing that sticks with me isn't the legal arguments, it's the maps.
What about the maps?
British Mandate era survey maps from the 1940s. The land parcels were still registered to Palestinian families from before 1948. I remember one sheet, a village called Al-Izariya. Cluster of names in Arabic script, each one a family, each family a parcel. My supervisor told me to label it as open area. The ministry didn't recognize Ottoman-era land registrations, so I changed the label.
You personally removed a village from an official government map.
I didn't remove the village. I removed the name. The village was still there. The map just stopped showing who lived there. That's how the planning worked. You didn't need to declare the land empty. You just needed the map to not show anyone on it. Then you could designate it for development.
Ma'ale Adumim is now a city of 40,000 people.
43,000? Last census. It's the third largest Israeli settlement in the West Bank. I drew the road that connects it to Jerusalem, Route 1. It's a six-lane highway now.
Did you think about it at the time?
No. I was 24 and I was getting paid by the hour. I thought about it later. About 15 years later, I was cleaning out a closet and found one of the old maps I'd kept. Al-Izariya was still on it. The original, I mean. Not the one I'd submitted. I looked at the name and thought, that family's still there. The village is still there. It's just not on any official document anymore.
The bureaucratic machinery is the occupation. Not just soldiers at checkpoints. The maps, the permits, the land registrations. That's how you move 500,000 people onto territory and make it look like suburban sprawl.
The British maps were accurate. They'd surveyed every parcel. Olive groves, wells, family compounds, all of it. We had better data about who owned what than anyone had ever had, and we used it to erase them from the record.
That's the detail you don't get from reading the ICJ opinion.
I'm not saying anything about the law. I'm just telling you what I did. I drew the roads.
The roads that connected settlements to Jerusalem. That made them commutable. That turned outposts into suburbs.
The land underneath those roads, the parcels you erased, they're still registered somewhere? The original surveys exist?
In an archive in Tel Aviv. Climate controlled, perfect condition. I checked.
Of course you did.
They're not secret. Anyone can request them. They just don't match anything on the current planning maps.
The legal argument is that there's no prior sovereign, but the maps show prior owners, individual families with names and parcel numbers.
The maps don't argue. They just show what was there.
That's the gap. Between the legal theory, disputed territory, no legitimate sovereign, and the physical reality of people who had deeds and olive groves and houses.
I should get home. Traffic's gonna be bad.
The cutting room floor detail I keep coming back to is this. The ICJ opinion cited Israel's own Supreme Court rulings multiple times. The court quoted the Israeli Supreme Court's own language about the applicability of the law of belligerent occupation to the West Bank. Israel's highest court has, in multiple decisions, treated the territory as occupied for legal purposes. So even within Israel's own legal system, The question isn't as settled as the government's official position suggests.
That's the irony. The Israeli Supreme Court has been more willing to apply occupation law than the political branches. The court has struck down specific land confiscations, ordered the rerouting of the separation barrier, and consistently referred to the West Bank as territory held under belligerent occupation. The government's international legal position contradicts its own judiciary.
That's not just an academic contradiction. It means that if you're a Palestinian petitioner, bringing a case to the Israeli Supreme Court, you can cite Israeli precedent that says you're living under occupation. But if you go to the international community, the same government that appointed those judges is arguing the opposite. It's a kind of legal double booking.
The classic example is the 2004 advisory opinion on the separation barrier. The ICJ cited the Israeli Supreme Court's own ruling that the West Bank is occupied territory. The Israeli government was simultaneously arguing to the ICJ that the barrier was a security measure, not a political border, while its own courts were treating the territory as occupied. You can't have it both ways, but they've been having it both ways for decades.
Where does this leave us? The ICJ says the occupation is unlawful and must end. Israel says it's a dispute to be negotiated. Both sides cite international law. What happens when the legal system itself can't resolve a political question? The settlements are expanding. The legal consensus against them is hardening. And somewhere in an archive in Tel Aviv, there's a British survey map with a village name that no longer appears on any official document.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running and for the maps.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to read the full ICJ advisory opinion or the Israeli government's legal defense, we'll link them in the show notes at myweirdprompts.com. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.